I'm just going to start with something a little silly that I love. You were probably watching the Olympics, so maybe you saw this clip, but this really made an impact on me. It spoke to my heart.
Hey, Don, I just met with the American men's team sitting in the stands. Pete Fenson said that they just wanted to be here to support the girls. They know that this is a crucial game, and you'll be impressed. You know, the guys were even participating with all the chants.
And the United States has got a little bit of a dilemma here because there is a double opportunity for the Danish team on the left-hand side on the two American rocks.
Yep. Whoa.
Best part coming right now.
Go, Marine.
Beautiful shot.
All right, thank you. So that reminds me of this next image you can see on the screen right here from Babylon Bee working their magic. Local pastor hoping curling metaphors go over big this Sunday. Isn't that just the funniest stuff? Curling is so lame. Am I right? Okay. I had a fourth grade teacher named Mrs. Bankus in New York who was into curling, and she took our entire class curling when I was in the fourth grade, and I'm still not into it. But anyway, that's just total filler. I'm here to talk a little bit about grace and addiction and the kind of interrelated spiritual nature of what goes on in the world of 12-step recovery and AA meetings and NA meetings and SA meetings and GA meetings and all the other different versions, Al-Anon and how that material that has changed and positively impacted so many lives also, in fact, has an enormous amount in common with, and in fact, comes out of, the kind of theological perspective that Mockingbird is so big on. You may know this, but AA started in an Episcopal church. I don't know if anybody knows that. Now, I'm an Episcopal minister. I work at a church in Charleston, South Carolina called Grace Church Cathedral. And many years ago when I was in seminary, I had the privilege of doing a summer placement, which is like a summer internship at a church where you sort of start to begin to take what you're learning in seminary and you sort of apply it and you get sent to do hospital visits, and you have to lead the 7 a.m. morning prayer service on a Tuesday that only three people come to. And I remember the guy, the local lay leader who led that service in the mornings at Calvary in New York City, was a former roadie for the Grateful Dead. And that guy schooled me when I was, you know, this seminarian in training in the ways of making use of the Book of Common Prayer early in the morning. I'll never forget how cool that experience was. But during that summer, I lived in an apartment in the building that's housed on the campus of Calvary in New York City, which is on between 20th and 21st and Park Avenue in New York City. And I lived in a converted apartment that for many years was the office of the rector, and that's just Episcopal speak for the head honcho, senior pastor of that parish. His name, in the 1930s and 40s, there was a famous guy there, at least he's famous in some circles. His name was Sam Shoemaker. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He wrote tons of best-selling Christian books. He was sort of like a Rick Warren of the 1930s. And Sam Shoemaker, he was an Episcopal minister, and he was the rector of Calvary. And he had a parishioner named Bill Wilson. And Bill Wilson is one of the famous founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill Wilson is the sort of original first draft author of this famous book, The Big Book. Also, the real title is Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where AA gets its name from. This is the classic basic text of AA, and it contains within it the first ever written version of the 12 steps, still the ones that you find in AA meetings today. Well, Bill Wilson had this profound spiritual experience after about his 19th stint in rehab, and he had a radical transformation, and he went to the rector of this parish, Sam Shoemaker, and he said, Sam, let me tell you about what's happened to me. Let me tell you about my story. I'm trying to figure out a way to describe the experience I've had. And Sam Shoemaker pulled out a pen. And in his office, he proceeded to write down, for the first time ever, the 12 steps. They came from a conversation between his parishioner, and he wrote them down, and that's where they first started. And I lived in the apartment that was that office while I was in the summer between my first and second year of seminary. That was very cool for me. People often talk about the founding of AA, which took place in Akron, Ohio. They celebrate something called Founders Day in AA on June 7th every year. That dates to June 7th, 1935, when Bill Wilson was on a business trip and freaking out about wanting to drink. And so he called up, he found a list of Episcopal churches in Akron, Ohio. And he got in touch with a vestry member of a parish there called St. Paul's. And he said, I need to talk. Actually, he tried a priest or, you know, a few different Episcopal people and said, hey, I'm an Episcopalian from New York City in town. I'm struggling with staying sober. I need to talk to an alcoholic. And all the different ministers who received that call said, no way am I going to put you in touch with my most vulnerable parishioners. And so they all said, the only thing worse than one alcoholic is two. The last thing I'm going to do is get them together. But this one brilliant woman that they spoke with, who was a member of St. Paul's in Akron, said, oh, I've got the perfect guy for you to talk to. And so Bill was given the phone number of a local doctor's house in Akron, Ohio, a man named Dr. Bob. And he called Dr. Bob's house. It happened to be Mother's Day at the time. And Dr. Bob answered the phone. Dr. Bob's wife, Lois, answered the phone. And she said, I'm so glad you called. It is true, my husband struggles. Today's Mother's Day, though, and I'm looking here in the kitchen at these beautiful flowers on the table that my thoughtful husband brought for Mother's Day. And I'm also looking at my husband, who's actually passed out lying under that table. And so why don't you come by tomorrow and not today? And Bill said, sure thing, no problem. And Bill, the next day, showed up to meet with Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob, who came to that night, the next morning, and was told by his wife, honey, I've planned a little visit for tomorrow. You're going to go and meet this guy. He's a sober alcoholic from New York City. And Dr. Bob grumbled and didn't want to go and whatever, and they walked into this meeting place in the woman's house who'd set it all up, and Dr. Bob met Bill. And Bob said, I don't think you can help me with my drinking problem. And by the way, Bill was an addict too. Bob was. And Bob said, I don't think you can help me with my drinking problem, to Bill, this stranger from New York. And Bill said famously, I'm not here to help you with your drinking problem. I'm here to stay sober. You're going to help me with mine. And people say that was the birth of AA. That happened on June 7th, 1935, and that is known in the world of AA as the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's still celebrated in Akron every year, and it is actually the birth of the Fellowship of AA. What I described to you at the beginning was the interaction between Bill and Sam Shoemaker. That's the birth of the program of AA. It's not celebrated as often, but it's essential and really interesting. And so Bill and Bob, the famous founders of AA, said there's a third co-founder of AA, and his name is Sam Shoemaker, an Episcopal minister. And something I do in my own life is I travel around to Episcopal churches, and I ask the clergy in these Episcopal churches to raise their hands if they host an AA meeting in their church. And what I find is usually some hands go up. And a lot of hands don't go up. And I say, look, you don't have to reinvent the wheel on any of this. All you have to do is open your doors to a ministry that started in your church and was an extension of your denomination's ministry. And I just simply say, all you have to do is open your doors. And I had an experience of this when I got to Grace Church Cathedral in Charleston, South Carolina. About 5.5 years ago, I was feeling out whether or not it was a call for me to go and serve there as one of the clergy staff. And at one point in the sort of long interviewing process, I asked the rector at the time, who today is my boss, his name's Michael. I said, just out of curiosity, does Grace Church host any AA meetings? And given what I've just told you, you know that that's me asking a very loaded question, sort of gauging where they are spiritually in asking that question. What do they value? Where are their emphases in their ministry? And this was his answer. He said, yeah, we gave him our best room. And that was all I needed to hear to know that I was interested in this parish and maybe working there, because it seemed to me that they had a good understanding of the importance of hosting AA as a kind of extension of their ministry in Charleston. And I had the privilege of attending some of those meetings early on when I was feeling it out. And our church is located in the middle of the College of Charleston, which is a lot of young kids, a lot of partying going on. And it turns out, too, there are not a lot of AA meetings downtown on the peninsula in Charleston, South Carolina. There are lots in the suburbs, not a lot downtown. And so the way that Michael came to offer AA their best room was because a member of the AA community scheduled a meeting with him one day and came to his office and said, hey, I'm a member of AA. We have a real need for meetings in this area. And I'm wondering if maybe you would allow us to have one here. To which he said, absolutely, we'll give you our best room. So I show up in this meeting, and the best room at Grace is something called the Meadowcroft Room. And it looks exactly like what you imagine when you think of Charleston. It looks like something out of Gone with the Wind. It's got ancient curtains and grandfather clocks and expensive rugs and antique wood furniture. And on a Friday night at 9 p.m., if you show up at Grace, you used to see all of these sketchy dudes and folks smoking cigars crazily outside of the meeting and then going upstairs. And they would walk into this church and they're going, and then they get to the Meadowcroft Room and they're thinking, are you sure that we're allowed in here? You know? And of course they are. So 7 years go by, or five and a half years go by. And one day I say to Michael, have you ever been to an AA meeting? And by the way, at this point, we've now started hosting multiple AA meetings during the week. And also, we've been able to start Al-Anon meetings and just have opened our doors and want to be a church that just is supportive of the recovery community and believes in the work that's going on there through the Holy Spirit. And I said, have you ever actually been to one of these meetings? And he said, no, I'm not an alcoholic. And he didn't know that there's such a thing as an open meeting. And so in that time period, something had happened. So many people in Charleston at 9 p.m. on Friday nights, mostly young people, had started coming to this meeting that they outgrew the room when they got 75 people showing up standing room only every week. And so then we moved from giving them our best room to giving them our entire parish hall, which is the size of this room, which is now completely packed out, standing room only, on Friday nights at 9 p.m. And I said, Michael, you know, the meetings are open that we host. It means anybody can come. You don't have to say a word. And nobody's going to feel weird. You know, there are going to be a lot of people who feel more awkward walking in the doors than you do. And he said, well, can I come to one? I said, absolutely. And so I showed up and I met him there and he walked into his parish. And by the way, he's the head honcho, as I mentioned. And he walked into a room full of people he'd never seen before in the church that he oversees and takes care of and typically feels very at home in. And he looked nervous. And, but also sort of fascinated. And he was glad to make eye contact with me. And we sat in the back, sort of back where Josh is sitting, so we could observe and not make anybody feel too uncomfortable. And he just sat there and he listened. And one of the things that happens is people pour in late. It's great. They say in AA, they close every meeting with the Lord's Prayer at the very end. They have a great line. You can use this in church if you're a leader or anything like that. They say, you're not late unless you miss the Lord's Prayer. So in church terms, I say, you're not late unless you miss the blessing at the end. But so we're watching people pour in, and Michael is flipping out because he sees there are no seats. And he's the head guy, and he's always thinking about how we need to, you know, get seats for the new person. He's thinking about the person who just walked through the doors and putting them at ease and making them feel at home. And I watched him. He kept trying to get up, and I said, "You just sit down and watch." And what he saw, we watched people from within the room, leaders of this meeting, get up and immediately giving their chairs away, running to closets we don't even know about, coming back with chairs we've never seen before. And after the meeting, one of the things he told me he loved so much was that they took ownership of the space for him to see that they were at home in this parish, more so than him in that setting. That moved him deeply. And then a little while later, the guy who came up to him 5 years earlier and asked if they could host an AA meeting walked up to him. And he said, "Michael, I don't know if you remember me. I'm Doug. I'm the guy who asked you if we could have a meeting here every week. And welcome." And it was unbelievable to see Michael being welcomed in his parish. And it was by the guy who all those years later had just asked him. And all we'd done is open our doors. And sure enough, it's like the seed, the parable of the seed in Mark. It grew overnight, whether he slept or was awake, and he knew not how. And 7 years or 5 years later, we opened the door to see if anything's been going on. And it's standing room only, packed, and an amazing source of life in our community. Isn't that cool? All right. So I'm a person who continues to hugely benefit from my involvement in AA, and my story begins at the age of 19 when I landed in a rehab in LaGrange, Georgia. My parents dropped me off with a suitcase, and I spent 21 days there after a series of problems, and I was there for substance abuse-related problems and depression, and I thought it was the end of my life, and it was the beginning of my life. And I now owe it to my congregation and to my family to go to meetings because for me, that's where I kind of recharge. And if I'm honest, AA is my favorite church. They wouldn't like that I call it that, but I do. I go there to continue to get inspired and to continue to hear fresh life breathed into the Christian message that I espouse. And I see the most incredible examples of how God works and examples of the kinds of things you read about in the Bible. And I just want to tell you a few little examples of what that looks like. I was in a meeting recently, and it was a week where the lectionary reading on Sunday, and I was preparing a sermon, was on the parable of the workers in the vineyard, my favorite parable probably. And I have a picture of it in my office. And you remember the one where the guy keeps hiring everybody as the day goes on, and even at the very end, he's hiring workers who are only going to work about 40 minutes. And at the very end, he pays all of them the same. Do you remember all of that? And I'm trying to figure out what to do with my sermon that week, and I just thought, well, I'm just going to go to AA and just stop thinking about this. And I'm sitting there, and at the beginning of the meeting, they ask, "Does anybody tonight want to celebrate? Is anybody celebrating an anniversary?" It was quiet, and then two hands went up. The first hand was a really old guy. And in AA, those are called old timers typically, and they're kind of revered for their wisdom and their long experience of sobriety and the spiritual life and all that kind of stuff. And they're wise, and sometimes they're jerks, other times they're the coolest. And this guy, they said, "How long do you have sober tonight?" And he said, "Tonight makes 41 years. And everybody said, "Wow," you know, and there was a little applause. And then they called on the second guy who had raised his hand, who was a lot younger than Mr. 41 years. And he said, "I've got 1 year tonight. Tonight is 1 year of sobriety." And everybody just exploded with applause. And then they asked the next question. "Is anybody here new tonight or visiting who would like to raise their hand so that we can welcome you?" And it was still. And then some courageous guy trepidatiously raised his shaking hand. And he said, "I've got 8 days back." And what happened? The whole room exploded with applause and affirmation and encouragement and support. And Just like that, I got my sermon for the parable of the workers in the vineyard. The way AA works is there's no hierarchy. You know that? There's not one person is better than another person in AA. Nobody has more power than anybody else in AA. Everybody has the same standing in AA. And the idea, the saying is, you're only the person who's sober the longest in the room is the person who got up first this morning. Isn't that a wonderful and fresh leveling of the playing field? So what happens, though, is a person who's kind of in a broken state shows up in an AA meeting looking for help. And instead of being told all these things they got to do and whatever, there is some of that. But what really happens is a bunch of people say, we know and remember exactly what it was like when we first came in. I still remember my first meeting. Most people do. And what happens is that a person who has been sober a long time, which is impossible to imagine or fathom for the addict who's got a few hours of sobriety, a person comes and says, I remember what it was like. I was you. They tell them stories about themselves and their own drinking and substance abuse related problems, how bad they were, how they were worse. It's the most insane and amazing thing. Something happens. Magic happens as people make themselves vulnerable and are open to talking about their struggles. The person who's new is filled with life and hope for at least 24 hours. And as I think about that, I think about this beautiful passage about Jesus from Hebrews chapter 4 that I love, which is sort of a portrait of the way that Christ entered into the flesh, entered into our midst, shared with us the experience of life on the ground. And it is from knowing not just that he is all powerful and almighty, but that he was also totally humble and experienced all of the temptations and difficulties that we experience, that we discover basically the empathy of God. And this is how it's put in Hebrews. We do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are. And whenever I read that passage, I think of AA. And I think about any time I've seen another person share their experience, strength, and hope in order to encourage a person who is feeling hopeless. I saw a really great example of this in my parish not so long ago. One of our members is a guy who turned 90 recently, and he's pretty old, in other words. And he was a tree of a man. He's 6'4". His name's Stuart. And Stuart, for years, he was a senior warden. That's like the senior guy of the lay people in the church. And he was a big executive, I think, in the Northeast for many years before he retired to Charleston. And very successful in the world's eyes. And he just has that commanding presence of success and authority and committedness and responsibility and all those kinds of things that a lot of people feel like they don't have. But at the age of 90, it doesn't matter how successful you were, death begins to work its thing on you, doesn't it? You begin to deteriorate. And Stuart, no exception. And Stuart ended up, through the experience of diabetes, having to have a toe amputated. And so suddenly he was laid up, and guess what? The toe amputation didn't go well. And after a few weeks of it not healing well and the circulation not sorting itself out, he was told, you know what, we hate to tell you this, we're going to have to amputate your whole leg down from just below the knee on that leg. And he, like a trooper, went and had that done and went from being this 6'4" stud to a frail 90-year-old man who couldn't get out of bed for a few weeks. And then when he did get out of bed, he was going to have to learn how to walk again with a prosthetic limb. And when he got back to his assisted living room at a retirement home where he now lives, and he had been in an independent living area, and suddenly Mr. 90 years old stud is living in a place where he has to be entirely cared for. He gets back to his room. His leg is gone. His life is starting to sort of fade, he gets a knock on the door. And there's a woman there, a nurse, and she says, excuse me, I'm looking for Stuart. Does anybody know where Stuart is? And he says, I'm Stuart. And she walks into the room and she says, oh, you're the person I've been looking for. You just lost part of your leg, right? He says, yes, I did. And she sits down right next to him in a chair next to his bed. And then she did this thing. She took off her entire left leg and she laid it on his lap. And she said, I'm here to help you in any way I can. She proceeded to then tell him that you won't believe the cool things they're doing with prosthetics these days. You can actually get an image printed on your leg. And the next thing you know, Stuart has, he's big into Scotland and his Scottish heritage. He's got a prosthetic leg now with his family tartan plaid going down the whole thing. And this past February, a few weeks ago, we have a service at our church that's a celebration of sort of Scottish stuff called the Kirkin of the Tartan. And it's amazing how many people own kilts in Charleston. And Stuart was right there in the middle, you know, standing about 2 inches shorter in his kilt, showing off his plaid peg leg. Now that's how empathy works. That's how AA really works. That's how grace works. And I just love that story. That was such a cool thing to witness. And so I've learned just, I'm constantly seeing the sort of interrelationship between the two things, and I'm always getting fresh inspiration. I just want to tell you one or two other little quick stories about how I often get schooled in AA about how ministry really works. We got a call at the church from a parishioner, and that's like a very loose word, a member of our parish technically who was married there in the 70s. And so, you know, it's been 30 years since they've been to church. And we keep them on our rolls, though. And, you know, we don't want to drop our number. That's called rector math. You always take whatever number you have and you add 20. We get this call that this person's calling saying, we were married at Grace years and years ago. My brother is dying, and he's dying of alcoholism-related stuff, and we're going to have to take him off of life support tomorrow. And we're wondering if there's anybody at the church who could come down and pray with our family beforehand. And the moment I heard the word alcoholism, my ears perked up. I got there on a Saturday, and by the way, that doesn't mean that like I enjoy going to the hospital on a Saturday morning. I don't. It's always a drag until I get there. And as I'm walking into the hospital with my collar on, I hear my name called, John Z! And I turn around, and there are three of my favorite people from my home group in AA, and they say, oh, yeah, we're going to visit a friend of ours who's fortunately sad situation. He's dying, blah, blah, blah. Turns out we were headed to the same room. They said, you know, this is our buddy. We go way back with him. He's been trying to stay sober for years. He hasn't had great success or whatever, but we heard today they're going to pull the plug, and we just thought we'd be there. So I walked into this room with three members of the program, and I'm saying the sort of, kind of heavy and sort of old-fashioned words to a person on his deathbed. And then I watched these guys gather around and say, remember driving that Datsun on Folly Beach? You know, and the guy's unconscious, but I think his spirit could hear them. It was amazing. And they showed me. And, you know, none of them had to be there. I saw what ministry really looks like. I had another experience years ago. A friend of mine, who's a friend of Mockingbird's, but who's got a history like all of us, years ago, I knew him, and I always wondered about his drinking, if I'm honest. I have a sort of radar for that stuff, and it goes off every once in a while, and doesn't mean I say anything, but sometimes I think about it, sometimes I pray about it. And this one friend of mine, you know, I kind of wondered, and then I did what I do, just like with church. I invite somebody to church. This guy said, you know, I don't know if you know this about me. I'm sober, and I go to AA, and I've got a history with that stuff. If ever you want to go to a meeting with me, I'd love to just accompany you. You wouldn't have to say a word, and just invited him, right? He said, and I dropped it. I planted the seed and I dropped it. A year later, I get a call from his wife. Will you bring my husband to an AA meeting? I say, all right, you know, I actually tried this a year ago, but maybe something's happened in the last year. So I called him and I said, hey, buddy, I don't know how you're doing. So it's a little awkward. I got a call from your wife. And anyway, she mentioned you might be interested in, or she might be interested in you checking out an AA meeting. And, you know, a year's going by, but I'm still doing that stuff and I still love it. And if ever you want to come with me. And he said, you know, and he never went with me. Then I lost contact with him until about 6 months ago. Out of the blue, I get a call, see his number, his name on my phone. Been wondering how he was doing. And I answer the phone. Hey, man, how are you? He says, not good. I've blown it all up. I'm calling you from my new apartment in a loft hotel. My marriage is over. Don't know if I'm going to get to see my kid. Can't stop drinking. Are you still going to AA? I said, I am. How'd you like to go to a meeting with me tomorrow morning? Guess what? He was there. He was ready. And we went and he loved it. And I said, you know, I'm not going to be the guy to take you through the steps to sponsor you or any of that stuff. We've got a lot of history and I want you to have to reach out awkwardly and, you know, ask some other person to help you with this program. I think that'd be a good experience for you. I'm not going to micromanage your stuff, but if I can help in any way, I will. And he then said, so what do I need to do? I said, well, they recommend you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. He said, great, I'll go to 270. Classic alcoholic answer, by the way. So he starts going to 3 AA meetings a week, I guess, or whatever. And, you know, we're texting a lot. And about 5 days later, you got a sponsor yet? You asked anybody to help you through this stuff? And then I get the text, yeah, I got a sponsor, you know. And then I stop hearing from him. And, you know, I'm praying for him and I'm trying to take the AA approach, really, you know, not trying to control this guy's situation and just letting go of that situation and trusting that God's gotten lots of people sober without my having to manage it or micromanage it at all. And every once in a while, maybe 5 days go by, I just text, hey, doing? He says, doing great. Day 14, day 17, you know. And then I don't hear from him for about a month. And Hurricane Irma rolls through Charleston. Y'all remember Hurricane Irma? It hit us really hard in Charleston and we were totally flooded out for days. Nobody could leave their house. It wasn't like what y'all experienced in Houston, but it was totally crippling for our city and it filled everybody with a lot of fear and all of that. And that night after being in my house all day long and sort of being stir crazy and kind of trying to take the AA approach of get out of my head, I'll talk to somebody else in the program, I shot my friend a text because I was worried about him. You know, how was he gonna do alone in a motel, you know, 30 plus days into the program when people start to often get very squirrely? They either think they got this and they relapse, or they start feeling like they can't take it anymore and they relapse. They call it 30 days and 3,000 nights in AA. And so I shot this guy a text, how you doing? And I got a text back from him, and this is what it said. You're not gonna believe this, but somehow this crazy alcoholic managed to hit 3 AA meetings in a hurricane. And for me, I learned a lot that day about how bringing people to faith and inviting people to faith works and how willingness works and where it comes from and that you can try all you want for years inviting people and they won't be ready. But when God says they're ready, they'll hit 3 AA meetings in a hurricane, right? And that to me was another profound lesson. I need to wrap up, but I just wanted to share with you some of this kind of stuff that for me just continues to speak and breathe life into all the things that I'm interested in. I was sitting in a meeting recently and an old guy said these words, which I was thinking sounded very Lenten. He said, some people had to die so that the rest of us can live. And I thought, wow, I know about one who died so that I can live. And I thought, these people understand atonement and are talking in those terms and don't even know it. And it reminded me, though, of the thing that for me as a Christian has been so helpful in my thinking about AA. Because you see, there are people who don't get sober or who get sober for a period of time and don't stay sober. And I always worry that those people are being given a message that they're failures or that God can't love them if they can't stay sober or something like that. And for me, the Christian faith is a thing that gives me great comfort when I think about the folks who have to die so that the rest of us can live. Because you see, I believe that the Christian gospel message proclaims that God has brought into this world in Christ a grace that is so expansive and so profound in its draw and ability to pull, and so gentle in its sincerity and tenderness, especially with those who are sick and suffering and who can't manage to get their lives together, that there is hope for those people too, the ones who die drunk. And that's the piece of the gospel message that I love to share with people in AA, because we all know people who have not made it through sober and who have died drunk. And there's hope for them too. And here's one example. I was sitting in a meeting one day, and I heard a man say this. His brother had died of alcoholism after years of failed attempts at sobriety. This is what he said. In the case of my brother, the only hope for him was death itself. My family and I take comfort in knowing that he is close to God now. I've never forgotten that. That blew me away. If you've never heard Tyler Perry's sermon that he preached at Whitney Houston's funeral, she who died of an overdose, it'll blow your mind when he talks about Romans 8, and he talks about the height, no matter the height and depth of God's love, and its power to save the lost, and preached that to a room full of people who were wondering about Whitney Houston, who, even though she couldn't stay sober, said, but the Lord, but the Lord, but the Lord. And I always want to interject that. And so finally, I just want to share with you one example of what grace looks like that I saw recently for the addict who can't stay sober and what it looks like when it comes into the world. So you may have seen this, but let's just close with this profound little clip, which I just keep watching over and over again.
Heroin and crystal meth control Crystal Champ's life.
It is everything.
The strangling grip of addiction has left her homeless on the streets of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I did give up, you know. I just decided that this was going to be my life.
Living in a tent.
Welcome to home.
In the brush alongside a highway.
I know how bad it is, you know. I'm the first one to know how bad my situation is. And
for Crystal, the thought of a guardian angel walking into her life was unimaginable. But that's what happened when Albuquerque police officer Ryan Holitz found Crystal and her companion Tom.
Hello, folks.
Shooting up heroin behind a convenience store in September.
Looks like you guys are getting ready to shoot up over here.
Ryan Holitz, okay. A father of four, wasn't ready for what he noticed next.
Are you pregnant?
Yeah, it's not every day that I see a sight like that. And it just made me really sad.
How far along are you?
8 months.
Oh my gosh.
And he goes, And you're pregnant?
Why are you going to be doing that stuff? It's going to ruin your baby. You're going to kill your baby.
His words brought Crystal to tears.
How dare you judge me? You have no idea how hard this is. You have no idea. And I know what a horrible person I am, and I know what a horrible situation I'm in.
In that instant, the moment changed.
His entire being changed. He just became a human being instead of a police officer. You know?
A crazy, overwhelming idea crept into Ryan's mind.
Realizing that she was desperately wanting someone to adopt her baby. I just felt God telling me, tell her that you will do it because you can. You can. And so...
3 weeks later, Crystal Champ gave birth, and Ryan Holitz and his wife agreed to adopt the baby they named Hope.
I've gotten tired of seeing so many situations where I want to help but can't. And in that moment, I realized that I had a chance to help.
Hope suffered through withdrawals during weeks of medical treatment, but she's gaining weight now and doing well.
Her father and me love her, you know, very, very much. And we did not give her up because we didn't want her.
But Crystal remains an addict and admits she's in no place to care for a baby.
I just want her to be safe and secure and, you know, be in a family and be loved and have a chance, you know.
I am so thankful and blessed and humbled that we're allowed to have Hope in our family.
When you think about like what it took for all the stars to align for you two to connect in the back of that convenience store parking lot, it's just crazy, right?
It's like providence. We'll be there for her, and whatever struggles that she has, we'll be there, and we'll work through it. And that's what makes me happy, that we'll be there for her.
For Officer Ryan Holitz, it's proof that even in the darkest moments, you never know when love and hope will reveal itself. Ed Lavandera, CNN, Albuquerque, New Mexico.
So I just want to say that for me, and when I think about this material, the gospel message, which is the heart of the Christian message, is that the God who you may have been told or had the wrong perception of, you may have thought he's like a cop, the heavenly cop. The great good news of Christ, who entered into the flesh, is that in fact he is like that police officer who cares and who wants to come alongside of you and love you. But also he's like that cop for the Christian who still continues to struggle and who can't put it together, who will continue to advocate for you and help you and be there with you as you walk through the difficulties that you will indeed discover you will face even as a Christian. And so this is a message that is for the person who's feeling estranged or far from God, and this is a person for the person who is a believer, who is struggling to believe that God still loves them. Indeed, he does. Thanks so much for letting me talk. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.